In a quaint New England farmhouse on an early summer's day, a farmer's boy became our chief in a homely, simple way. With neither pomp nor pageantry, he firmly met the task. To keep him on that job of his is all the people ask. So keep cool and keep Coolidge is the slogan of the day. Keep cool and keep Coolidge for the good old USA. A lot of politicians cannot do a thing but knock, but Calvin Coolidge is a man of action and not talk. So keep cool and keep Coolidge in the White House 4 years more. We have a chance to do it in this year of 24. He's been tried, he's never wanting, he is giving of his best. So keep cool and keep Coolidge in our country's mighty test.
Welcome to the Abridged Presidential Histories with Kenny Ryan. Episode 30, Calvin Coolidge, Silent Cal. When Ronald Reagan became president in 1983, he sent someone into the cabinet room to take down a portrait of Harry Truman and hang one up of Calvin Coolidge, the 30th president, instead. And at first blush, Silent Cal looks like an ideal poster child of modern conservative thought. Coolidge was a president who famously said, "The chief business of America is business." He cut taxes, he reduced government spending, and oversaw 6 years of economic growth that his biographies call the Coolidge Prosperity, but you probably know as the Roaring Twenties. He was such the personification of small, do-nothing government that Coolidge once told a colleague, "If you see 10 troubles coming down the road, you can be sure that 9 will run into the ditch before they reach you." In other words, don't worry about them. But the problem for Cal wasn't the 9 problems that went into the ditch. It was the one that didn't. The one he did nothing to stop, and that he only avoided because his term in office ended just in time for him to step aside and let it hit Herbert Hoover smack in the face instead. That 10th problem is, of course, the Great Depression. So today, we'll look at what was behind the Coolidge prosperity, the ways Silent Cal turned PR into presidential relations, and the root causes of the greatest depression in world history. John Calvin Coolidge, that's right, his name is John, was born on July 4th, 1872 in Plymouth Notch, Vermont, to Victoria Coolidge and John Calvin Coolidge. That's right, his father had the exact same name as his son. They were both John Calvin Coolidge. And they must have realized this was confusing because Daddy-O went by John and the son went by Calvin their entire lives. So, Calvin Coolidge, son of John Coolidge, was born and grew up in Plymouth Notch, Vermont, a small village of farmhouses that didn't have gas lamps, running water, or coal furnaces. It was a Spartan childhood spent helping Calvin's strict father, John, around the farm, building fences, tapping trees for syrup, and so on. And it didn't get any more comfortable after Cal's mother, Victoria, died in 1885, when Calvin was just 13. The thing is, Coolidge's father was a hard-working man and a dedicated public servant, the sort who asks for few comforts, demands maximum effort, and gives the same in return. In addition to running the family farm, John Coolidge served every local elected role imaginable. He was a selectman, a school commissioner, a tax collector, a constable, a deputy sheriff, a state representative, and a state senator. As we will see, he definitely served a role model for his son Calvin. In 1891, Calvin went off to college at Amherst. He failed his initial entrance exam, got another year of education elsewhere, and then got accepted to Amherst after that with the help of his schoolmaster. And I'll be honest, With college tuitions what they are today, knocking out your basics at a cheaper university or community college might be the norm pretty dang soon. But back to Calvin. Coolidge graduated from Amherst in 1895 and then apprenticed at a legal firm to study law. But what he really ended up getting was an education in politics. The law firm Calvin signed on to specialized in the mundane. Literally, the boring lawsuits and legal work that somebody has to do but nobody wants to do, which is so Coolidge. It was a drip of work that kept the firm's partners employed so they could focus on their real passion, politics. Calvin soon followed there and his father's footsteps by winning election to the Northampton City Council with the help of his law firm connections in 1897. And he never strayed far from politics again. For the next 30 years, Coolidge methodically climbed every step of the political ladder. And I mean every step. 1 year as a clerk of courts here, 2 years as city solicitor there, another couple years as mayor somewhere else. You get the sense he'd have run for dog catcher if the position existed. He only lost once, a 1905 race for a seat on a school board, but he won election to the state legislature the following year and kept on climbing. In 1903, he met a woman named Grace Goodhue, a University of Vermont graduate and teacher at the local school for the deaf. 2 years later, they got married. They had a pair of sons together, John and Calvin, in 1906 and 1908, and that is right. John Calvin broke the streak of John Calvin's by splitting the difference and naming one son John and the other son Calvin, which is one way to name your kids, I guess. Calvin raised his family much as his father had raised him, strictly and frugally. The family didn't own a car, even though they were now normal. And his phone line was shared by all his neighbors, as in zero privacy. Theodore Roosevelt's sharp-witted daughter Alice once said Coolidge looked as if he had been weaned on a pickle. Calvin's sons, John and Calvin, remembered John Calvin, I still can't get over these names, for being a strict father who teased their insecurities. One son had a summer job on a farm where another young man said, "If my dad were president, I wouldn't work my summer on the farm," to which Calvin's son replied, "If you had my dad, you would." In 1919, all that political climbing finally brought Cal to the top rungs of the Massachusetts political ladder, the governor's mansion. Well, not the mansion. There was no mansion in Massachusetts, but he was elected governor, so he rented one $1 hotel room for business, and another $1 hotel room to house his family. Yeah, the guy is cheap. And this is actually the first time anything interesting happened in his whole career. 1919 was a crazy year. As World War I ended, the country struggled to transition from a government-run war economy to a private sector-run peace economy, and inflation took off like a rocket. Overseas, Russia had gone communist and people were freaking out. American laborers revolted when corporations tried to cut their wages and increase their hours. Some 4 million Americans went on an estimated 2,665 strikes in 1919 alone. And in the middle of all that, the Boston police joined the party, going on strike that September. Police, like any other laborers, can get shitty contracts. That was the case in Boston, and the police were extra eager for better wages and benefits due to the unrest and expenses of the post-war years. When the police tried to negotiate a better contract and the city said no, they unionized. When the chief of police then fired the union leaders, the police voted to strike 1,134-2. Roughly 1,100 of Boston's 1,500 cops walked off the beat. When word of the strike spread and folks realized the cops weren't on the streets, people started looting. And then they started rioting. Rioting in the streets of Boston, that's not very good. The press asked Governor Coolidge, do you think you should be doing something to stop this? And he said, nah. Probably thinking this was one of those 9 out of 10 problems that would end up in a ditch on its own. But things got worse. The Boston Police Commissioner decided to punish the police union by firing all the officers who had joined the strike. And you may be surprised to learn that did not solve the problem. After a couple days of rioting, Cal called the state militia to put down the violence. And when the fired police officers reached out to him to say, this is all the fault of that commissioner who fired us and we should get our jobs back, Cal responded with a telegram that made him famous, writing, quote, your assertion that the commissioner was wrong cannot justify the wrong of leaving the city unguarded. That furnished the opportunity. The criminal element furnished the action. There is no right to strike against the public safety by anyone, anywhere, anytime. This stand that no right to strike against public safety line, it won him a lot of national support because it met the mood of the moment. People were sick of strikes and terrified of Bolshevik violence. In hindsight, did the police commissioner cause this by refusing to negotiate a new contract, refusing to recognize the police union, and then firing the union's leaders and all the police who went on strike? Yeah, absolutely. But in the heat of the moment, everyone was just mad at the police for walking off the job. And so, Silent Cal, whose whole mantra could be summed up as, when you see a problem, don't fix it, was suddenly a hot name, getting favorable press around the country just in time for the 1920 GOP convention. And he was starting to attract some influential backers. By this time, 2 of his college friends from Amherst had become rich bankers at the J.P. Morgan Bank. Rich enough to fund his campaign. He also befriended a 33-year-old ad man named Bruce Barton, who was basically a political PR consultant before such positions even existed. Barton is such a 1920s guy. In 1925, he wrote a book titled The Man Nobody Knows that said Jesus Christ was the world's first CEO and pushing this idea that Christianity wasn't about helping the poor, it was actually about getting rich. Which, well, I'm not Christian, but I'm not sure which part of the gospel he was reading. To help Coolidge's 1920 candidacy, Barton wrote a number of puff piece articles that got passed off and published as if they were unbiased journalistic profiles, helping cement Cal's image as a member of the great silent majority before that team even existed. Despite this support, Cal never made much of a wave for president during the 1920 convention. In part, this was because Massachusetts Senator and old Theodore Roosevelt ally Henry Cabot Lodge split the state's delegates with his support for Roosevelt's old friend, the former Rough Rider and presidential contender, Leonard Wood. But after Harding was nominated, the party's attempts to impose a vice presidential nominee on the convention were drowned by a revolt on the floor. As various party leaders and loudmouths vied for control, it's not entirely clear why, but Cal's name became the loudest shouted from the floor. And those shouts became a flood that nominated Coolidge for VP by acclamation. Just like that, Calvin Coolidge, the quiet and austere Vermonter who had dedicated his life to civil service, was named the GOP nominee for vice president. A few months later, Calvin and Harding won the general election, moving Cal to Washington, D.C. And that's where most expected Cal's story to end. Because remember, I mean, the vice presidency has long been considered a joke. I mean, Woodrow Wilson's vice president, Thomas Marshall, the outgoing guy, he liked to tell a joke that went like this. There was once a man who had 2 sons. One of the sons went to sea and drowned, and the other was elected vice president. Neither son was ever heard from again. But Coolidge was more involved than most VPs. Harding invited him to participate in cabinet sessions, something that was nearly unprecedented. Thomas Marshall, who I just mentioned, he had presided over Woodrow Wilson's cabinet when Wilson was off negotiating the end of World War I in Paris, but that's it. Coolidge was usually quiet and rarely participated in these cabinet meetings, mind you, but he was kept up to speed on the challenges and opportunities the executive office was dealing with. And so, Cal may have been the best prepared vice president in history when, in 1923, an ailing Warren Harding went on a trip west, so sick his doctors secretly loaded a coffin on the train just in case. And then just in case happened when Harding died in San Francisco on August 2nd, 1923, lifting Coolidge to the presidency. And this next part is actually pretty neat. Calvin, he was at his father's home in Vermont when Harding died. The house had no phone, so the news had to be delivered to the front door. When the messenger knocked, Calvin's dad, John, answered. And then John went upstairs to tell Calvin, "Son, you're the president of the United States." But it gets even better. Remember how John Coolidge was always holding down one public office or another? He was a public notary at this time. And so John Coolidge didn't just tell his son he was president. He also swore him into office right then and there in the old family home. Just like that, the Coolidge years had arrived. And so, on August 2nd, 1923, 51-year-old Calvin Coolidge, Silent Cal, the famously quiet public servant who hadn't really done anything of note to date, became the 30th president of the United States of America. But what did the world and the country look like when Coolidge became president? Let's look around and see. Internationally, Russia was just wrapping up a civil war with the Bolsheviks emerging victorious over conservative reactionaries. Over in Germany, hyperinflation was destroying the economy and threatening the young German democracy. That will not end well, by the way. And down in the Middle East, Egypt had just gained independence from Great Britain in 1922. Domestically, the United States was starting to calm down and rediscover prosperity after its own post-war economic crisis. There had been inflation, a Red Scare, race riots, including the 1921 Tulsa race riot, when one of the most affluent black neighborhoods in America was attacked by a mob of whites who destroyed businesses, looted the area's wealth, and killed and injured hundreds. Hidden mass graves from this event are still being found today. 35 city blocks were destroyed, and then 6,000 surviving African Americans were imprisoned for as many as 8 nights. This somehow wasn't taught when I was growing up, which is crazy, and I'm not going to let it slip by here. But by 1923, the race riots were starting to quiet. The Red Scare was over, the economy was recovering. As Coolidge took over, he looked up the road and couldn't see a single problem coming his way, let alone 10 of them. But that didn't mean Americans were feeling confident about their new leader. They took another glimpse at his resume and realized it showed 20 years of pushing pencils and one police strike. There weren't any hints of greatness lurking there. A popular joke compared Cal to a baseball player who reached first base on a walk, stole second base, got to third on an error, and reached home because the catcher died. But you know, Coolidge and the whole Republican Party might have really lucked out on the timing with which Harding died. Remember those big scandals from the Harding episode? Teapot Dome and the Veterans Bureau. That all hit the press right after Harding died and right as Coolidge was taking over. And that might make you think is bad news for Coolidge, but shockingly no. Silent Cal simply said that was the other guy's administration, proved it by firing anyone implicated, including the Attorney General, and then skated through the controversy relatively unharmed. Sometimes silence is a virtue. And then Cal did, well, basically nothing. Cal was a true conservative. He believed in minimal taxes and minimal regulation. Have you ever heard the phrase, the government that governs least governs best? Cal took that to extremes. Take a look at his typical workday. He held some meetings in the morning, took a long nap every afternoon, then smoked cigars into the evening, and went to bed early. Once, when he was at a Marx Brothers performance, the comedian Groucho spotted him in the audience and quipped, "Isn't it past your bedtime, Calvin?" One of Cal's rules of thumbs was never do anything that someone else can do for you, which is not what you'd expect to hear from someone who had such a strict, hardworking childhood, but maybe the guy was plumb worked out. Cal delegated everything to his cabinet members, and then he largely stepped aside. So I'm going to tell you about things that happened during his administration, things his administration did, but just remember, this was largely the work of his appointees, and Calvin was spending most of his time taking naps and smoking cigars in the White House. Well, let's start with the topic Coolidge and the 20s are most known for, the economy. The U.S. economy took off like a rocket in the 1920s. After a post-World War I slump, the GDP grew by 15.8% in 1922 and 12.1% in 1923, then averaged 3.5% growth the rest of Coolidge's term. By comparison, 2% is considered decent today. By the mid-1920s, the United States was producing half the world's economic output and half its manufactured goods, despite having just 6% of the world's population. And all that money wasn't just going to the top. Average Americans were seeing revolutionary changes in the ways they lived. The number of cars on the road tripled from 7 million in 1919 to 23 million in 1929. The percent of households with electricity leapt from 16% in 1912 to 60% in the mid-1920s. And the new medium of radio boomed from $60 million of sales in 1922 to $842 million at the end of the decade. Just imagine, in one decade, going from a household that had no electricity, traveled by horse, and was detached from the world, to a household with electric lights, a car, and a radio bringing you news and culture from the nation's greatest metropolises. That is a wild change. But what was driving it? Harding and Coolidge fans will tell you a magic sprinkle of the most drastic tax cuts in U.S. history were the trick, but most of the GDP growth happened in the years before taxes were cut, and then slowed down after they were cut, so I'm not quite buying that. Instead, I think the answer is human ingenuity. As in, there were market forces greater than any one person or political party at play here. The sort of economic great leap forward that comes around once in a while and sweeps everything along with it. And it had three main components. Number one, the expansion of credit. Banks loosened up and made it easier for the masses to borrow money, which they could then spend on consumer goods, which they wanted to do because of number two, the growth of the ads industry. Advertising was becoming a major industry these years, convincing Americans that they wanted to spend their money on luxuries that once seemed unimaginable or out of reach, like beauty products, cars, and radios. And all of these products were suddenly less expensive because of number three, the spread of methods of mass production. Henry Ford introduced the mass production of automobiles in 1910, and the concept took off and spread to other industries in the 1920s. This meant more stuff could be produced for less money at a more consistent quality. The price of a new Model T Ford, for example, dropped from $850 in 1908 to $300 in 1924. Can you imagine that? Things getting cheaper by as much as half or more over time? That's not what you expect the economy to do. So everywhere you looked, ads were suddenly telling you to buy cars, buy radios, and other luxury goods. Those items were suddenly more affordable than they'd ever been, and it was easier to borrow money than it had ever been. Add that all up, and the economy boomed. Of course it did. And even though the folks in Washington, D.C. had nothing to do with that boom, everyone thought they did, including themselves. And so they started to push the throttle on some other policies that, well, were going to have some consequences. So what did they do? For one, they started dismantling economic regulations that had been put in place during the Progressive Era. For example, Coolidge did not hire any new Food and Drug Administration inspectors. He allowed the agency overseeing the railroads to fall apart, and he allowed the creation of near monopolies in the new field of radio. Changes that were good for big businesses, but not great for labor or consumers. Over in the Treasury Department, one of Coolidge's few holdovers from the Harding administration was also doing everything he could to help the rich. Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon was the third richest person in the United States. He was the one who advocated for those big tax cuts I mentioned earlier, which I should add were mostly to the rich. Mellon cut taxes for the Americans making more than $200,000 a year from 73% to 25%, while he cut taxes for the poorest Americans from 4% to 1.5%. So this was absolutely being felt more at the top than at the bottom. But that's just the above-the-board stuff Mellon was doing to help the wealthy out. The Senate did a little digging during the 20s and found Mellon had given $3.5 billion of rebates to big businesses, including some he had financial interests in. He also returned $80 million of inheritance taxes to the heirs of some of the nation's largest estates. This is basically Mellon saying that the biggest businesses and richest Americans didn't really have to pay all their taxes, but everyone else should. The thing is, Mellon and Coolidge were working from an economic theory that if you cut taxes on the wealthy, they would spend more, the economy would grow, and that money would end up in the pockets of the middle class and poor. This theory would later be called trickle-down economics, but here's the deal. The entire history of the world is a history of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer until revolutionary events snap that inequality closer to an equilibrium. Think about it. At the dawn of time, everybody had nothing. If wealth trickled down, then wealth would never have accumulated in the first place. As soon as someone had more than everyone else, it would have trickled back down to the others. But that's not what happens. The more wealth someone has, the more power they have. The more power they have, the more wealth they're likely to attain. I digress. 1 year into the job, things were going pretty well for Calvin. The economy was growing, and Coolidge was all too happy to take responsibility. But re-election was not guaranteed, because there was at least one man more popular than Calvin Coolidge in America. And that man was Henry Ford. Ford had revolutionized manufacturing and was putting a car in reach of nearly every American. Of course he was popular. But the real question was, did he want to be president? And Calvin was afraid the answer was yes. So, in 1924, Coolidge called Ford up to Washington, met him privately for some time, and when they parted ways, Ford told everyone who would listen that he had no interest in the presidency and everybody should vote for Calvin Coolidge. And then Coolidge asked Congress to give Ford a killer deal on some government land in Alabama. And then Cal cruised to re-election without Ford running to oppose him. Did Coolidge just pay Ford off to keep him out of the presidential race? The Senate seemed to think so, as it ultimately blocked the deal. But the whole thing stunk to high heaven. Beyond the economy and re-election, there are three things from the Coolidge administration worth mentioning. The Veterans Bill, the Immigration Bill, and the Mississippi Floods. I'm going to start with the Veterans Bill. This will be important when we get to the Hoover episode. While the 1920s were pretty great economically, there was at least one group of Americans who felt they were getting left behind. World War I veterans. In a time before the GI Bill, when health, housing, and education benefits didn't exist as they do today, World War I's veterans felt they'd gotten the short end of the stick. They'd been over in Europe fighting for democracy, while their friends who didn't get drafted had been home making mint during the booming war economy. The veterans thought the government should pay them a bonus to help make up the difference and to thank them for their services. And this wasn't a novel idea. I mean, you might remember, Civil War veterans received a hefty post-war pension when Benjamin Harrison was president back in the 19th century. But soldier bonuses are expensive, and shoot, Cal might just have to raise taxes back up on the rich if he wanted to pay for something like that. So he opposed the Veterans Bill and vetoed two versions of it that were passed by the Senate in 1924, saying, quote, "Patriotism bought and paid for is not patriotism," which is a hell of a way of saying we shouldn't have to pay our troops. But there were 3.3 million veterans in the country, and this was a popular issue. So a veterans bill eventually passed over Coolidge's veto in 1924, but not one that would pay out right away. The idea was this: a life insurance policy was set aside for each veteran with $1 for each day of home service and an additional $1.25 for each day served overseas. Money that would be raised over 21 years because these life insurance policies would not pay out until the year 1945 while you're still alive, or the veteran's death, whichever came first. When the Great Depression hits and those veterans demand their bonuses early, it's going to become a big deal. So that's the Veterans Bill. Next up, the Immigration Bill. The 1924 Immigration Bill is one of the harshest immigration bills in U.S. history. It straight up outlawed Japanese immigration and said every other nationality was limited to a percentage of that nationality living in the United States in 1890. This extreme nativist bill would be the law on immigration until 1965 and would be blamed for the deaths of millions of European Jews during the Holocaust who, due to the quotas, were unable to seek refuge in America. And this is why I will always support easier immigration policies. This immigration bill also signaled the start of the Ku Klux Klan's interest in the Republican Party. The Ku Klux Klan, they're back! They had originally been a bunch of white terrorists intent on subjugating the freedmen after the Civil War until President Grant crushed the organization in the 1870s. And they were gone. But then, in 1915, a Methodist preacher in Stone Mountain, Georgia, brought the Klan back to life. By the 1920s, the Klan was having a major resurgence, and not just in the South. Anywhere white Protestants were unhappy with minorities, Jews, or Catholics moving in, the Klan set up shop. Klansmen saw the GOP passing restrictive immigration laws and said, you know what would be great? Corrupting the party of Lincoln. Governors and state legislatures of both parties owed their elections to the Klan's support around the country. And in some areas, the Klan resumed its violent history of lynchings, beatings, arson, and brandings. This was, unsurprisingly, a political challenge for both parties. While most political leaders found the Klan repugnant, both parties realized they had Klansmen in their ranks and among their constituents, and they feared the political costs of condemning the Klan. In 1924, that election that Henry Ford stayed out of, the Democratic presidential nominee did eventually condemn the Klan after much pressure, and then he challenged Coolidge to do the same. But Coolidge refused to do it, and he never would. Even when 40,000 Klansmen marched past the White House in 1925, Coolidge never brought himself to say a bad thing about the Ku Klux Klan. So, that's the immigration bill, a harsh, xenophobic restriction on immigration that would contribute to the deaths of millions of Jews and make the KKK think the GOP was A-OK. Not great. But there is one more big item to mention. The Mississippi floods. So, I think we all know the Mississippi River is the biggest river in North America, right? Well, that means when something bad happens to the river, it impacts a lot of people. And in 1927, something terrible happened to the Mississippi River. It started in late 1926, when it began to rain and snow and rain, and it didn't let up. Straight into 1927, it was raining at levels never before seen. And the Mississippi Basin couldn't handle it all. Rivers overran their banks, dams and levees began to fail, and the worst flood disaster in U.S. history unfolded smack dab in the middle of the country. By April 1927, 16 million acres were under as much as 30 feet of water. Levees had been breached in 140 different places. Hundreds were dead, and hundreds of thousands were displaced and homeless. Aid was desperately needed. And Calvin Coolidge said, nah, I'm not kidding. Congress was in recess and Cal refused to summon it back to DC where it could pass legislation to offer relief. Instead, he dispatched Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover to lead the relief effort in collaboration with the American Red Cross. To be fair, Hoover was an inspired choice. During the early years of World War I, Hoover had led a relief effort that fed starving Belgians and French citizens trapped behind German lines. And he played a similar role in the American Relief Administration after the war, feeding 23 countries that had been left in shambles by the Great War. Now, Coolidge derisively called Hoover Wonder Boy behind his back, but Hoover had a solid resume for bringing aid to devastated regions. Ordered to supervise relief to the Mississippi Basin, Hoover did what he could. When private fundraising didn't raise enough, Hoover pointed to the federal surplus and asked Calvin if some of that could be given to those in need as well. But Cal again resisted giving a dime to Mississippi flood victims. Cal, he refused to visit impacted areas, and he refused to broadcast an appeal for aid on the radio. Nothing happened until Congress finally returned from recess and passed a bill over Coolidge's head directing money to the flood victims. And it's worth saying, the suffering of this flood fell disproportionately on African Americans. There are stories of African Americans being forced at gunpoint to work on levees or build refugee camps without compensation. At least one was shot and killed for refusing to work. And there are further stories of African Americans being refused entry to the relief camps and forced to fend for themselves. White women and children, on the other hand, they were removed to safety. The disaster and Coolidge's response contributed to the drift of African Americans away from the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, and toward the Democratic Party, as well as further encouraging a migration of Southern blacks to northern cities. And you might be thinking you've never heard of this flood, but I bet you actually have. Led Zeppelin's When the Levee Breaks is a reworked version of a 1929 song about this flood, written by African-American singer-songwriter Memphis Minnie. So that is the Mississippi Flood, and the Immigration Bill, and the Veterans Relief Bill, three very significant events or legislative achievements that may have happened on Coolidge's watch, but I'll be damned if he had anything to do with them. The funny thing is, though, despite this detached leadership, Cal was very popular during his time in office, and not just because the economy was humming. The thing is, the one part of his job that he did appear to spend time on was public relations. Barton, that political advisor I mentioned from the 1920 campaign, he was still around getting puff pieces into all the newspapers. Coolidge biographies are full of humorous anecdotes that make Cal sound like a funny, nice, fun guy, but nobody can actually find out where any of these stories come from, and they might all be the work of Barton. And it's impressive because the stories that you actually can trace to Cal paint a picture of a mean and bitter man. The White House staff was kept in perpetual fear of being fired at any moment for any reason. Once, when Cal was out on a fishing trip, a Secret Service agent caught more fish than Coolidge, and Cal immediately ended the trip and went back home to sulk in his hotel room. But nobody saw that side of Cal. Instead, they saw video and photos of Cal working on the farm, hanging out with business titans and celebrities who all endorsed him, of course. And they heard him talking to them on the radio. It was a masterly evolution in presidential PR. On August 2nd, 1927, Coolidge asked all the members of the press at the White House to line up, and he silently handed each of them little slips of paper, and then left without saying a word. When the reporters looked at their slips of paper, they read simply, "I do not choose to run." And just like that, Coolidge let the nation know he would not seek re-election. On November 6, 1928, the nation elected Herbert Hoover, hero of the Mississippi floods and so many other relief efforts, to be the next president. Toward the end of Coolidge's presidency, the economy did start to show signs that something might be wrong. Consumer buying plateaued. Despite the strong decade, half of Americans were still living on subsistence wages. And yet, the stock market was soaring ever higher, entirely detached from any measure of corporate value. There were some red flags in there for sure, but you know Cal. He didn't do a thing. On March 4th, 1929, Calvin Coolidge left the White House for the last time. His presidency over. 7 months later, the economy collapsed with a stock market crash known as Black Friday, and a decade of Great Depression began. So, how had America changed during the 6 years of the Coolidge administration? One huge change that I didn't mention is that on June 2nd, 1924, Coolidge signed the Indian Citizenship Act, which granted U.S. citizenship to the roughly 125,000 indigenous peoples who hadn't been granted citizenship yet. This didn't necessarily mean the Native Americans could vote, because voting rights are controlled by states, and many states refused to let them vote. And this was also opposed by some tribes, the citizenship. Some of these tribes did not want to be citizens, but this law is a big deal. Other changes are... In 1923, a pair of brothers with a funny-sounding last name created a new cartoon studio in Hollywood, California. The last name was Disney. You might have heard of it. Also, the cheeseburger was invented in 1924 when 16-year-old Lionel Sternberger of California put a slice of American cheese on a hamburger at his father's Pasadena sandwich shop, and wow, was that a good idea. Internationally, remember that German hyperinflation I'd mentioned earlier? About that. The German hyperinflation was making it hard for Germany to pay its war reparations from World War I. So, in 1924, a Chicago banker named Charles G. Dawes was put in charge of a reparations committee to sort this out. The plan he came up with was this. Germany would abandon its hyperinflated currency for a new one that it would declare was worth more than the old mark. They basically said 1 million old marks equals one new Reichsmark, and everyone actually went along with it because the economy is really more psychology than science. France and Belgium, which had occupied part of Germany over its delinquent payments, would evacuate those areas, and the West would loan Germany $200 million, which could then be used to pay Germany's existing debts back to the West, which of course created new debt for Germany in the process. And this set up a system where the US is loaning Germany money that Germany paid to the Allies in the form of reparation payments so the Allies could pay off their World War I debts to American banks. This would, for the most part, be how Germany paid its reparations and how the Allies paid their war debts until the Great Depression sent it all tumbling down in 1929. Oh, and in January 17th, 1929, Calvin Coolidge signed the Kellogg-Briand Peace Pact, a treaty his Secretary of State had negotiated with dozens of other large nations, including Germany, that outlawed war, which is why we've never heard of another war being fought anywhere anytime since. Great job, Cal! Cal lived another 4 years after his presidency ended, and he never could understand why the Great Depression happened or how the country might get out of it. He mostly stayed to himself in Vermont and avoided the limelight. When FDR, who Coolidge considered a socialist, was elected in 1932, Coolidge told a friend, "We are in a new era to which I do not belong." A month after that, January 5th, 1933, Cal suffered a fatal heart attack while changing in his bedroom. His wife found him dead on his back. He was 60 years old. If you're going to remember Calvin Coolidge for anything, I think you remember him for being possibly the luckiest president in U.S. history. I'm not kidding. Who gets as lucky as Coolidge? First, he became president by accident because he was VP when Harding died. Nobody actually thought Coolidge should be president. He only made it in as a fluke. Second, there were zero international wars or crises, and when the Great Mississippi Flood did hit, the most destructive flooding disaster in U.S. history, he didn't do a thing and somehow got away with it. Just ask George Bush what happens if you don't handle disasters perfectly today. Third, the economy was booming the entire 6 years of his administration. There were zero hiccups. It was all gravy train all the way. And fourth, he left office just before the Great Depression hit, dodging that bullet by a matter of months. Nobody gets that lucky. As for what lesson in leadership can we learn from Cal? Let's address this whole, if trouble is coming down the road, don't do anything philosophy. Now, it's not healthy to be trying to fix everything in the world, because you can't fix everything in the world, but it'll also do you no good to never try at all. So, here's the lesson. Whenever you see something wrong in the world, ask yourself one question. Can I do anything about it? If the answer is yes, do it. If the answer is no, then it's okay to have a moment to channel your inner Calvin Coolidge and let yourself not worry about it. What's important is finding that balance. Learn when to worry, when to delegate, and when to let things go. Nobody can take on everything and stay sane. Thank you for listening to today's episode of Abridged Presidential Histories. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, tell all your friends and family about the show, and leave a 5-star review on your podcast listening platform of choice. You can also follow the show on Facebook at Abridged Presidential Histories or on Twitter at APH Podcast. If you'd like to support the show, you can look it up on Patreon or go directly to www.patreon.com/abridgedpresidentialhistories. This helps me buy books and pay to host the show, and thank you so much to everyone who's contributed so far. The music in today's podcast is a public domain recording of the United States Army Old Fife and Drum Corps and When the Levee Breaks by Led Zeppelin and Memphis Millie. The intro music was a recording of Oscar Brands from Smithsonian Folkway Records. The primary biography for today's episode was Calvin Coolidge by David Greenberg. In our next episode, I'll talk to David Greenberg about how Silent Cal mastered the budding art of public relations and the 1920s evolution in advertising to sell himself to American voters, and just how much credit or blame he deserves for the Roaring Twenties and the Great Depression. That's next time on Abridged Presidential Histories. Are you interested in some additional presidential history from the early days of the Republic? Go check out the Presidencies of the United States podcast, hosted by Jerry Landry. I recently joined Jerry for a pair of episodes about the life of President James Madison, with a special focus on his 8 years as Secretary of State for Thomas Jefferson. At the end of the episodes, we ranked how Madison did as Secretary of State, and I was surprised by the results. You can find those episodes on the Presidencies of the United States podcast, episodes SATT 15.1 and 15.2, James Madison Part 1 and James Madison Part 2. Happy holidays, folks. Hope you're all doing well.